Mother's Questions and Answers, April 18th, 1956. In this class, we again return to the intriguing subject of the Master and the Mother, the two who are one, the two who are the might and right in all things, the two whose trance of bliss sustains the mobile world, and of course, this is Mother and Sri Aurobindo. And in this class, Mother explains the necessity for us to have a complete perception and realization of both the Master of Existence, Ishwara, and the Universal Mother, Shakti, or as she is sometimes called, Ishwara Shakti, the power of the Master. Or sometimes she is simply called the Mother. And in many other cultures who have a similar or same concept, she is also called the Mother. Mother points out that when the seeker separates the Master and the Mother, or separates the Master from the Mother, and gives more importance to one of them than to the other, there is a lack of balance. There is a lack of balance in the whole process and in the result also. The power of the seeker's realization is not perfectly supported. To say that in different words, it means that the power of the action of the Shakti is not perfectly supported by the Master. And therefore, the Universal Mother's creation in the seeker, and also through the seeker, is not as effective. The full consciousness of the Mother and the Master, and also the consciousness of their relationship, cannot be realized in that case. This means, realized means, it cannot be translated into a creation. To fully serve the divine, to be a complete and total servant of the divine, you have to realize both the divine and his power. Then everything acts through you, and you are at your best and most effective. If the seeker is conscious of the Master without having the consciousness of the Mother, the result is a realization which carries the seeker's consciousness into the unmanifest impersonal, and he or she realizes nirvana. They go out of the creation, and this was always the goal of yoga until now. Now Sri Aurobindo brings back the truth of the importance of both. And this integral realization creates an integrally realized and integrally functioning being. In Sri Aurobindo's descriptions of his own yoga practice, which he wrote in his diary, The Record of Yoga, he achieved the complete union of the Master of Existence, the Purusha, and the Mother of the World, the Prakriti, in his own being. He says, and it must be his experience, he says it is done through the ecstatic surrender of Prakriti, the ecstatic surrender of our nature to Purusha. And in this case, it's to our soul, which is the connection with the Divine Master, as well as the connection with the Divine Mother. And then this becomes the seeker's basis of divine action and the seeker's divine enjoyment. At this time in his sadhana, Sri Aurobindo wrote, he was also seeing the Master and the Mother everywhere he looked outside himself, seeing them as separate, and separating them in our thoughts and feelings is liberative. However, liberative means liberating us into nirvana. And seeing them as unified is dynamic and effective, which means dynamic and effective not only here, but on every plane. As Sri Aurobindo kept going into higher and higher levels beyond the mind, going up the hierarchy of all the mind that we have in us, he observed that one of the things that changed in him was the relation between the Purusha and the Prakriti. in his own self-experience and in his own world experience, everything changed when the two really became one, and all their relationship and all their action were all unified in his own consciousness. The nature of our mind is to separate things. Our mind divides, it catalogs, it distinguishes one thing from another. But the separation of Prakriti and Purusha does not fulfill the purpose of their cosmic play. It only liberates the seeker and frees him or her from the action of nature. But freedom is not an end in itself. It's a stage where one now can work towards divine perfection. In the synthesis of yoga, Sri Aurobindo explained how this helps the liberated seeker to arrive at mastery and perfection. He says, while the seeker is rejecting what is undivine or seemingly undivine in nature, he or she can rebuild the mother's forms and movements in him or herself, according to a nobler pattern and the law and rhythm of a greater existence. But because of the nature of our mind to separate instead of to unify, we have to rise above the mind. Then this separation, or you can say our perception and living, this separation of Purusha and Prakriti, gets annulled. It gets changed and removed or canceled more and more in the experience of having the consciousness and delight of their unity. Sri Aurobindo wrote, at a certain spiritual and supramental level, the duality becomes still more perfectly two in one. The master soul, with the conscious force and all its potentiality within it, disowns all barriers and breaks through every limit. By 1927, the entries in Sri Aurobindo's record of yoga show that his realization of the complete union of the two in one was complete. There's something really lovely to listen to Mother talking about this to the students. Because here, Mother is speaking about herself, and she's speaking about Sri Aurobindo and their unified work in the world. This is what they took birth for. And they worked in the outside world, and they worked in the ashram, and they're still working. They did all this so that that full realization could come to mankind. And it's really lovely to see how tender Mother is and how carefully she works to explain all of this to these very special and fortunate young people. On the tape, she says things in a way that could possibly be a little difficult to follow if they're printed in a book. But I'm going to say it as it was on the tape, because they definitely bring us a closer understanding. Somehow the very personal manner of her saying them really imparts something that she really wants to say. So whether you speak French or not, you might like to listen at least to the beginning of the tape. It's just to hear the wisdom and the softness and tenderness in Mother's voice. After that, she answers a question about our soul, our psychic being. A girl asks Mother about a sentence in the synthesis of yoga, where Sri Aurobindo says that the soul carries within it the forecast of the aim and motive of the universal labor. And this fact, which Mother, of course, knows, is brought home again to Mother in a really sweet way 14 years later, on July 1st of 1970. There was an American disciple in the ashram called Rijuta. And Rijuta means straight, undeviating. I remember Rijuta. She was very straight, no nonsense, no dilly-dallying, no shilly-shallying, no useless participation in social things, no extra talk, absolutely focused on her yoga practice and her work. She kept her head shaved, and she wore white shorts and a shirt, the costume that the women wore in the playground to do their exercises, and that's how she lived. Well, on July 1st of 1970, Rajuta was in Mother's room, and Mother saw Rajuta's psychic being. When Mother told Satprem about it, and you can find this conversation in Mother's agenda at the 1st of July, 1970, Mother said she had never bothered to know what the psychic being looked like before. Now, all of a sudden, she saw Rajuta's soul, her psychic being. Mother described it as being larger, taller, and bigger than Rajuta's body all around. It was neither male nor female, but it had features of both combined, and it was the color that Mother says is the color of Auroville. It's a very difficult color to describe. It's the color of the Auroville flower, and it's a kind of golden pink behind a kind of orange. It's not coral, it's something very beautiful. Rajuta's psychic being said to Mother, "You're wondering what the supramental being will be. Here it is. This is it." And so Mother first knew all that at that time. And she knew then that the part of us that will remain all through our evolution and transformation, the part that will become a supramental being, is what we already are. That part of us which is the most eternal and immortal part of us, our individual soul. Eventually, this us will materialize into a supramental being in a supramental substance, a material substance. It will happen as our consciousness and all the rest of us that's capable of being completely taken over by the psychic being and completely open to all of these influences, when all of that continues to be transformed down through time. Today we can look back through time and see what Sri Aurobindo meant, or at least part of what he meant, when he said that the soul carries within it the forecast of the aim and hint of the very motive of the universal labor. After this, we have a question from that particular disciple, which Mother allows to ask questions. He wants to know how to go to other worlds. And Mother asks him if he can exteriorize himself, if he can leave his physical body and live in a more subtle body, and again leave that body for a more subtle body, and so on. This is something which Mother herself knew how to do, and did do. Around 1907, Mother went to Algiers to stay for the second time with Max Theon, the occultist. Mother was already an experienced occultist herself, and she did a work with Theon that included exteriorizing herself from her most material sheath, her physical body, through 12 successively subtle sheaths, again and again exteriorizing, all the way up to the upper limit, and then out of the most subtle aspect of the manifestation into a place where the source was sleeping. And this source was the being that contained all the future. So when Mother spoke of this in her class, she was speaking out of her own experience. And after that, Mother tells us a beautiful story about how small children can create their own wonderful future. We have the tape, obviously, and it will play right after the English translation. We're in Mother's class. It's the 18th of April of 1956. Mother has finished reading the French translation of The Synthesis of Yoga, and they're on the subject of the master and the mother. It's not on the tape, but here in the book they print a paragraph that someone asks a question about. It goes like this. At one pole of it, the seeker may be conscious only of the master of existence, putting forth on him his energies of knowledge, power, and bliss to liberate and divinize. The Shakti may appear to him only an impersonal force, expressive of these things, or an attribute of the Ishwara. At the other pole, he may encounter the World Mother, creatrix of the universe, putting forth the gods and the worlds and all things and existences out of her spirit substance. Or, even if he sees both aspects, it may be with an unequal separating vision, subordinating one to the other, regarding the Shakti only as a means for approaching the Ishwara. There results a one-sided tendency, or a lack of balance, a power of effectuation not perfectly supported, or a light of revelation not perfectly dynamic. It is when a complete union of the two sides of the duality is effected and rules his consciousness that he begins to open to a fuller power that will draw him altogether out of the confused clash of ideas and forces here into a higher truth and enable the descent of that truth to illumine and deliver and act sovereignly upon this world of ignorance. And then Mother says, the two aspects. Have you understood what the two aspects are? And then a girl starts to speak, but Mother goes on. The master of existence and the universal mother, isn't it? Ishwara and the Shakti. The master of existence and the universal mother. There. Yes, if he sees the two aspects, that is to say, the master of existence and the universal mother, he may see them with an unequal vision, which would mean that he still separates them and gives more importance to one than to the other. This is what it means. And then in that case, there is a one-sided tendency where he sees only one side, you see. Or there is a lack of balance between the two perceptions. And then a power of realization which is not perfectly supported. That is to say, the action of the mother without the support of what he calls the master, you see, the action of the mother does not have a sufficient basis of support from the master. Or else, it is the light of a revelation. That is, the consciousness of the master, the light of the relationship, which is not realized, not perfectly dynamic, that is, not translated into a creation. Either it is the creative power that is not supported by the realization, or it is the realization which is not expressed in the creative power. This is what Sri Aurobindo means. There is a tendency to go towards one or the other instead of having both at the same time, as when one no longer separates them in one's consciousness. Sri Aurobindo says that it is when one succeeds in not separating them in one's consciousness that one can fully understand who the Lord of the sacrifice is. Otherwise, one leans to one side or the other, and naturally, what one does is incomplete. He says it very clearly, doesn't he? That if one leans to the side of the master without insisting on the Shakti or the mother, then one goes into the impersonal, isn't it? And out of the creation, one returns into nirvana. While, if one leans to the other side, and then Mother stops and she doesn't really go into what happens on the other side. She changes. She says, you see, he says that this tendency towards the impersonal may exist even even in the yoga of works, you see, in karma yoga. And it is the impersonal force, impersonal action, which is always considered as the liberating aspect, which frees you from the narrowness of the person. And he says that is why there is nothing surprising in the overwhelming strength of this experience. It means that when one has the experience of the impersonal, up to the present, this has always been considered as yoga, to abandon the personal and enter into the consciousness of the impersonal. Sri Aurobindo speaks of it here as an overwhelming experience because it gives you the impression of liberation from all the ego's limitations. And then, this which he describes later, the union, the insistence on the personal side, and union with the divine person, you see, in this case then, the world is no longer an illusion, not something transient which will disappear after a time, but the constant and dynamic expression of the eternal divine person. You see, that is the other side. And when one has the two together, one is perfect. Anything else? And then she asks the girl, are you contented? And the girl says, yes. And then another girl asks, sweet mother, what is this beautiful flower of the cosmic energy? And mother says, And she says, this beautiful flower of the cosmic energy. And mother still can't hear her, and mother says, And then the girl reads, this beautiful flower of the cosmic energy carries in it a forecast of the aim and a hint of the very motive of the universal labor. And mother asks the girl, where is this sentence? And the girl tells her the page number. It's on 28. And mother says, it is the soul, isn't it? It is the soul which he calls this beautiful flower of the cosmic energy. And mother reads, the soul is not a brief-lived stranger in an impersonal eternity, but contains the very meaning of its existence. And then she says, this is the presence of the divine person, isn't it? And then she reads, this beautiful flower of the cosmic energy carries in it. And then she breaks in on herself and she says, this beautiful flower of the cosmic energy is the soul. And then she continues reading, carries in it the forecast of the aim and a hint of the very motive of the universal labor. And then she says, the realization of the conscious and living eternal. That's it. It is the hint of the aim, and the very motive of the labor. And then there's a silence. And mother says, is that all? And then she speaks to the disciple who asks so many questions. And mother says, do you have a question? Isn't there a question? He says something which you really can't hear. He must be very far from the mic. And mother says, has it disappeared? And then he reads, immediately afterwards, he says, Sri Aurobindo writes, quote, as an occult vision opens in him, the seeker, he becomes aware of worlds behind, in which consciousness and personality hold an enormous place and assume a premier value. But it's still hard for mother to hear, and so another disciple repeats it. And mother says, and so, what do you want? We have spoken about this I don't know how many times. What do you want to know about this? You want a description of these worlds? Or the means of going there? Which of the two? And he says, the means of going there. And Mother hears that. And she says, the means of going there. And he says something else completely inaudible. And Mother says, then do you know how to exteriorize yourself? Do you even know what it means to exteriorize yourself? Not philosophically or psychologically. I mean occultly. Are you conscious in your exteriorization? Do you do it at will? Do you know how to leave your body and live in a more subtle body? And then again leave that body and live in another more subtle body and so on? Do you know how to do that? Have you ever done it? And the disciple says, no. And Mother says, no. Then we shall speak about it again another day. And then he says, it happens in dreams, Mother. And she says, in dreams? Do you know where you are in your dreams? Then he says, a little. And she says, a little? This is becoming interesting. And where do you go in your dreams? And he says, often in regions which are... And Mother says, what regions? And he says, vital regions. And she says, oh, you go into the vital world. And nothing unpleasant happens to you there. And he says, most often. And Mother says, and how do you get out of it? And he says, rush back into the body. And Mother says, huh? And he says again, rush back into the body. And Mother asks, is that where your knowledge ends? And he says, no. Sometimes there is a call. And then one sees there is no need to rush back. But it doesn't last long. And Mother asks, it doesn't last? He says, no. And she asks, but do you go in and out at will? And he says, not at will. And she says, can you return to a place you have already been to several times before? And he says, no, Mother. And she asks, you don't find the same place again several times? And he says, not at will. And she says, ah, but there are children who know how to do this. They continue their dreams. Every evening when they go to bed, they return to the same place and continue their dream. And then he says, when I was a child, I used to do that. And suddenly the whole class full of all the children start laughing very loudly. One has not heard them like this on the mic laughing, and they laugh for a very long time. And then Mother says, you are no longer a child. That's a pity. And he says, because I had no preoccupations then. And Mother says, well, become a child once more, and you will know how to do it again. Nothing is more interesting. It is a most pleasant way of passing the nights. You begin a story. Then, when it is time to wake up, you put a full stop to the last sentence and come back into your body. And then the following night, you start off again, reopen the page, and resume your story during the whole time you are out. Then you arrange things well. They must be well arranged. They must be beautiful. And when it is time to come back, you put a full stop once again and tell those things, stay very quiet till I return, and you come back into your body. And you continue this every evening and write a book of wonderful fairy tales, provided you remember them when you wake up. And then he asks, but this depends on being in a quiet state during the day, doesn't it? And Mother says, no. It depends on the candor of the child and on the trust he has in what happens to him and on the absence of the mind's critical sense and a simplicity of heart and a youthful and active energy. It depends on all that, on a kind of inner vital generosity. One must not be too egoistic. One must not be too miserly. One must not be too practical, too utilitarian, Well, there are all sorts of things one should not be, like children. And then one must have a lively power of imagination, for I seem to be telling you stupid things, but it is quite true, for there is a world in which you are the supreme maker of form, that is your own vital world. You are the supreme fashioner, and you can make a marvel of your world if you know how to use it. If you have an artistic or poetic consciousness, if you love harmony, beauty, you will build there something marvelous which will tend to spring up into the material manifestation. When I was small, I used to call this telling stories to oneself. It is not at all a telling with words in one's head. It is a going away to this place which is untouched and pure, and building up a wonderful story there. And if you know how to tell yourself a story in this way, and if it is truly beautiful, truly harmonious, truly strong, and truly coordinated, this story will be realized in your life. Perhaps not exactly in the form in which you created it, but as a more or less distorted physical expression of what you made. That may take years, perhaps, but your story will have the tendency to organize your life. But there are very few people who know how to tell a story, and then they always mix horrors in it, which they regret later. If one could create a magnificent story without any horror in it, nothing but beauty, it would have a considerable influence on everyone's life. And this they do not know. If one knew how to use this power, this creative power in the world of vital forms, if one knew how to use this while one is yet a child, a small child. It is at this time that one constructs his material destiny. But generally, people around you, sometimes even your own little friends, but above all, parents and teachers, dabble in it and spoil everything for you to the point that very seldom does the thing succeed completely. But otherwise, if it were done like that, with the spontaneous candor of a child, you could organize a wonderful life for yourself. I am speaking of the physical world. The dreams of childhood are the realities of mature age.
Les deux aspects, tu as compris quels sont les deux aspects.
Oui. La mère universelle.
Le maître de l'existence et la mère universelle. N'est-ce pas? L'Ishwara et la Shakti. Le maître de l'existence et la mère universelle. Alors. J'espère s'il voit les deux aspects, c'est-à-dire le maître de l'existence et la mère universelle, il peut les voir avec une inégalité dans la vision. C'est-à-dire qu'encore il les sépare et qu'il donne plus d'importance à l'un qu'à l'autre. C'est ça que ça veut dire. Et alors, dans ce cas-là, il y a une tendance unilatérale, ça veut dire qu'il ne voit qu'un côté, n'est-ce pas? Ou un manque d'équilibre entre les deux perceptions. Et alors, un pouvoir de réalisation qui n'est pas parfaitement soutenu. C'est-à-dire l'action de la mère sans le soutien de ce qu'il appelle le maître, n'est-ce pas? L'action de la mère qui n'a pas une base suffisante du soutien du maître. Ou bien la lumière d'une révélation, c'est-à-dire la conscience du maître, n'est-ce pas? La lumière d'une révélation qui ne se réalise pas, qui n'est pas parfaitement dynamique, ça veut dire qu'il ne se traduit pas dans une création. Ou c'est le pouvoir créateur qui n'est pas supporté par la révélation, ou c'est la révélation qui n'est pas exprimée dans le pouvoir créateur. C'est ça qui nous dit. On a ou l'un une tendance vers l'un ou vers l'autre au lieu d'avoir les deux en même temps si on ne les sépare plus dans sa conscience. Il dit que c'est quand on arrive à ne pas les séparer dans la conscience qu'alors on peut comprendre complètement ce qu'est le Seigneur du sacrifice. Autrement, on penche d'un côté ou on penche de l'autre. Et là, naturellement, ce que l'on fait est incomplet. Si, il dit très bien, n'est-ce pas, que si on penche du côté du maître sans avoir l'insistance sur la Shakti ou la mère, alors on s'en va dans l'impersonnel, n'est-ce pas? Et hors de la création, on retourne au nirvana. Tandis que si on penche de l'autre côté, il dit que même cette tendance vers l'impersonnel peut exister même dans le yoga des œuvres, n'est-ce pas, le karma yoga. Et que on considère toujours la force impersonnelle, l'aspect impersonnel, comme l'aspect libérateur, qui vous libère de l'étroitesse de la personne. Et il dit c'est pour ça qu'il y a il n'y a rien d'étonnant à la puissance écrasante de cette expérience. C'est-à-dire quand on fait l'expérience de l'impersonnel, c'est jusqu'à présent ce qui a toujours été considéré comme le yoga. C'est d'abandonner la personne et d'entrer dans la conscience de l'impersonnel. Il parle de ça comme d'une expérience écrasante parce qu'elle vous donne l'impression de la libération de toutes les limitations de l'ego. Et alors, là, il décrit après l'union, l'insistance sur le côté personnel et l'union avec la personne divine, n'est-ce pas? Et que dans ce cas-là, le monde n'est plus une illusion, et ni une chose passagère qui disparaîtra après un temps, mais qui est l'expression constante de la personne, l'expression constante et dynamique de la personne divine éternelle. Et ça, c'est l'autre côté. Quand on a les deux ensemble, alors on est parfait. Bien compris. Autre chose.
Quelle est cette belle fleur de l'énergie cosmique?
Hein?
Cette belle fleur de l'énergie cosmique, ici, la palette.
Hein?
cette belle fleur de l'énergie cosmique porte en elle une prévision du but et un aperçu du motif même du labeur universel.
Où est-ce que c'est? En 28. C'est vers la fin. C'est l'âme, n'est-ce pas? C'est l'âme qu'il appelle cette belle fleur de l'énergie cosmique. L'âme n'est pas une étrangère de courte durée dans une éternité impersonnelle, mais qu'elle contient la raison d'être même de l'existence. La présence de la personne divine, n'est-ce pas? Cette belle fleur de l'énergie cosmique porte en elle, cette belle fleur de l'énergie cosmique, c'est l'âme, porte en elle une prévision du but et un aperçu du motif même du labeur universel. C'est là ce qu'il a mis ici, n'est-ce pas? La réalisation de l'éternel conscient et vivant. C'est ça là, n'est-ce pas? L'aperçu du but. Et le motif même du labeur. C'est tout. Pas de questions. Pas de questions. Elle a disparu.
Aussi pour la lumière, à mesure que la vision en cours se développe, alors on réalise il perçoit le monde au-delà, dans lequel la conscience et la personnalité tiennent une place énorme.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a?
À mesure que la vision occulte se développe en lui, il perçoit des mondes au-delà, dans lesquels la conscience et la personnalité tiennent une place énorme, et assume une valeur de première importance.
Et alors, qu'est-ce que vous voulez? Nous avons parlé de ça je ne sais combien de fois. Qu'est-ce que vous voulez à ce sujet? Vous voulez la description de ces mondes ou le moyen d'y aller? Lequel des deux?
Le moyen.
Le moyen d'y aller? Alors, vous savez vous extérioriser? Savez-vous seulement ce que c'est que de s'extérioriser? Pas philosophiquement ou psychologiquement, je veux dire occultement. Êtes-vous conscient dans votre extériorisation? La faites-vous volontairement? Savez-vous quitter votre corps et vivre dans un corps plus subtil, et puis encore quitter ce corps-là et vivre dans un autre corps plus subtil, et ainsi de suite? Savez-vous faire tout ça? L'avez-vous fait? Non. Alors nous en reparlerons un autre jour.
Paris même dans la veille.
Oui. Vous savez où vous êtes dans vos rêves? Ah, un petit peu, ça devient intéressant. Et où allez-vous dans vos rêves?
Souvent dans les régions qui sont...
Quelles régions?
Les encombrés de...
Hein?
Dans les régions vitales.
Oh, oh, vous allez dans le monde vital. Et il ne vous arrive rien de désagréable? Et comment est-ce que vous vous tirez d'affaire? Hein?
Sans fille. Sans fille encore.
C'est là que se borne votre connaissance.
Donc, quelquefois, il y a un appel, et là, on voit qu'on n'a pas besoin de sans fille.
Ça ne dure pas. Mais vous centrez, vous sortez à volonté. Vous pouvez retourner à un endroit que vous avez déjà fréquenté auparavant. Vous ne retrouvez pas le même endroit plusieurs fois. Mais il y a des enfants qui savent faire ça. Ils continuent leur rêve tous les soirs quand ils vont se coucher, ils retournent au même endroit, ils continuent leur rêve.
Quand j'étais un enfant, j'ai fait ça.
Vous n'êtes plus un enfant. C'est dommage. Eh bien, redevenez un enfant et vous saurez le faire encore. Il n'y a rien de plus intéressant. C'est une occupation pour les nuits qui est tout à fait agréable. Vous commencez une histoire, quand il est temps de se réveiller, vous mettez un point à la dernière phrase et vous rentrez dans votre corps. Et puis la nuit suivante, vous repartez, vous rouvrez la page et vous recommencez votre histoire pendant tout le temps que vous êtes sorti. Et puis vous arrangez bien les choses, il faut que ça soit bien arrangé, que ça soit bien joli. Et puis, quand c'est le moment de revenir, vous mettez encore un point final et vous dites aux choses, restez bien tranquille jusqu'à ce que je revienne. Et vous rentrez dans votre corps. Et vous continuez ça tous les soirs. Et vous écrivez un livre de contes de fées merveilleux. À condition que vous vous souveniez quand vous vous réveillez. Ça dépend de la candeur de l'enfant et de la confiance en ce qui lui arrive et de l'absence d'un sens critique mental et d'une simplicité de cœur et d'une énergie jeune et active. Ça dépend de tout ça. D'une sorte de générosité vitale intérieure. Il ne faut pas être trop égoïste, il ne faut pas être trop avare, il ne faut pas être trop pratique, trop utilitaire. Enfin, il y a toutes sortes de choses qu'il ne faut pas être, comme sont les enfants. Et puis, il faut avoir un pouvoir d'imagination vivante. Parce que j'ai l'air de vous raconter des bêtises, mais c'est tout à fait vrai. Il y a un monde où vous êtes le suprême formateur. C'est votre monde vital à vous. Vous êtes le suprême formateur et vous pouvez faire une merveille avec votre monde si vous savez vous en servir. Si vous avez une conscience d'artiste, de poète, si vous aimez l'harmonie, la beauté, vous bâtirez là une chose merveilleuse qui aura tendance à pousser vers la manifestation matérielle. Quand j'étais petite, c'est ce que j'appelais se raconter des histoires. Ce n'est pas du tout se raconter avec des mots dans sa tête, c'est s'en aller dans cet endroit qui est vierge et y bâtir une histoire merveilleuse. Et quand vous savez vous raconter une histoire comme ça, qu'elle est vraiment belle, vraiment harmonieuse, vraiment forte et vraiment coordonnée, cette histoire se réalisera dans votre existence. Peut-être pas exactement sous la forme où vous l'avez créée, mais comme une expression plus physique, plus ou moins déformée de ce que vous aurez fait. Ça prendra peut-être des années, mais ça aura tendance à organiser votre existence. Mais il y a très peu de gens qui savent raconter une belle histoire. Et puis ils y mélangent toujours des horreurs qu'ils regrettent après. Si on pouvait faire une histoire magnifique sans aucune horreur dedans, rien que de la beauté. Ça aurait une influence considérable sur l'existence de chacun. Et ça, il ne le sait pas. Si on savait utiliser cette puissance créatrice dans le monde des formes vitales, si on savait utiliser ça quand on est un enfant, un petit enfant, c'est à ce moment-là qu'on construit son destin matériel. Et généralement, les gens qui vous entourent, quelquefois même vos petits camarades, mais surtout les parents et les professeurs, ils barbotent là-dedans et ils vous habillent tout, au point que il y a très peu de fois où que la chose peut réussir totalement. Mais autrement, si c'était fait comme ça, avec la candeur spontanée d'un enfant, vous pourriez vous organiser une existence merveilleuse. C'est l'âge où on peut se... Je vous parle du monde physique. Les rêves de l'enfance sont les réalités de l'âge mûr.